This episode brought to you in part by Special Tees Custom Printing.
Visit special-tees.com.
That's special-tees.com.
Future Fantascope and the Nerd Camp Network present Camp Nightmare, a podcast for happy campers. There'll be fun, fiends, and ghosts. Maybe even a few murders. And of course, you're all invited.
Hello, campers!
Oh my goodness, welcome to the end of the month of November.
That's right, I am Jordan.
I am JB.
And you are listening to Camp Nightmare, and today we have a very, very special guest.
A fucking legend.
Fucking legend, and one of my personal favorite horror composers and film composers in general, Mr. Christopher Young, is joining us today. If you don't know the name, you will after today, and I know you know the tunes.
You do.
Because you have heard his music. He has scored films like Hellraiser, Drag Me to Hell, Sinister, Flowers in the Attic, Spider-Man 3, Pet Sematary Remake.
And it's not just horror. He's also done The Hurricane with Denzel Washington about Hurricane Carter. The Rum Diary about early Hunter Thompson. He did
Swordfish.
He did Swordfish with a buddy of mine, BT, Brian Tranzo, who's actually from this area.
Oh, cool.
Brian did. So BT is pretty much credited as like the godfather of trance. He's not really, but he was the first American artist to do trance in America. But he did all the electronic stuff, and I believe Chris did like the score,
symphonic stuff,
which is still fairly electronic. But Chris also did he did a movie called Bandits with Billy Bob Thornton that's really great.
The both Grudge films, Exorcism of Emily Rose. He's done more fucking movies than we could possibly name in the next hour and 20 minutes.
Just look up his IMDb page
and just gaze upon its glory. And today, Christopher is going to be with us talking not only about his prolific film work and how he approaches film scoring, but also his new project, which is compiling 25 books of his original experimental photography. So that's something he's going to talk with us as well. It's really exciting, but before we bring Christopher into the room,
let's get into some what's new.
First, we got to give a shout out to a brand new camp counselor, Ryan. Thank you for joining our Patreon family.
Welcome.
We've been having a bit of a wild boar problem on the outskirts of camp, so I think we're going to set him up in some sort of hidden tree lodge with some sort of pellet
face
gun.
Face paint
and a pellet
camo.
Gun and a bag of peanuts, and he's going to be keeping us safe from all the wild boars. Thank you very much,
Something
Ryan.
Something about the name Ryan just says I like to hunt.
Yeah. And so he likes to keep his camp safe. So thank you so much for joining our Patreon family. If you guys want to shout out and to get all the extra cool Patreon stuff that Ryan's getting, head over to patreon.com/campnightmare, where you can find exclusive episodes, B-movie watch-alongs, and a whole hell of a lot more. Up next on What's New.
Oh, man.
This whole Scream fiasco just keeps getting screamier.
It started with Marissa Barrera taking an unpopular stance on the whole Israel-Hamas thing.
Right.
Listen, we're not even going to touch that with a 10-foot pole because that shit is... we don't live in Israel. We don't live in Palestine. But she took a stance pro-Palestine. And unfortunately, the society we live in right now, nuance is no longer a thing. So you can't just express an opinion and have someone be like, oh, that's wonderful that you have an opinion.
And she had an impassioned opinion about death in this world. And that's something that I feel like we can understand. When there's atrocities going on in this world, people are going to be upset. And unfortunately, like you said, there's no room for subtlety. And the powers that be deemed what she said as anti-Semitic.
Which, let me state for the record, that's bullshit that there's no room for subtlety. We will take that stance.
Oh, there is room for it. There's just... there hasn't been a seat left for it at the table lately.
Karen and I were talking about this yesterday, that we've really lost the ability in our society to say, wow, you have a differing opinion from me. You have a different worldview than I do. Okay. We've lost the ability to do that. It's
there's
nowadays,
no discussion anymore.
Right. And, you know, there are certain tent pole, like human rights things that I don't think anybody can disagree on.
Right.
And I, again, I'm not going to get into whether or not this is one of those issues. What we do know factually that happened is that she took a very passionate stance that was pro-Palestine, and she was asked to leave the production as a result. Whether that's because the people making the movie were afraid that they were going to get labeled as anti-Semites, blah, blah, blah. Who cares?
I don't
know.
Was
asked
they
to
made
leave.
The call. And it was not Christopher Landon's call either.
No,
it was
not
the director's
not.
Call.
It was definitely the studio's.
He was fielding, he put out a tweet. I think his quote was, "Please, everybody, stop screaming. This was not my choice."
That's, dude, 100%. And what a great statement to make is, "Please, everybody, stop screaming." So then Jenna Ortega, in a show of solidarity, left.
Actually, that's the popular narrative, but that's not what happened. Jenna Ortega had told them ahead of time, before any of this went down, that she was not going to be involved.
Really?
Because of scheduling conflicts with Wednesday season 2.
I thought it was a solidarity thing.
That's sort of the narrative that's been spun now for obvious reasons because that
because
news
again
came
there's
out
no room for subtlety.
So
there's...
obviously because she was leaving at a similar time it had to be connected.
Well, and what they, you know, it makes for a better narrative that they formed
more dramatic.
This union of
Scream sisterhood, you know, they leave together.
Yeah.
But that's not what
so
happened.
Either way, there's a full creative reboot happening
for
Scream.
They got to ground up this thing. I mean, they lost all their leads. And you know where this is going. They're going, it's going to be, it's Neve Campbell or nothing now.
Well,
I mean, we're going to have a Gale Weathers-led film, in which case, just shoot me now.
Or if they totally reboot it.
Right.
Which, at this point, maybe just like, cut your losses and like reboot this shit.
Yeah, fuck it. Make a Stab movie. Make Stab.
I would be here for that if they made a Stab movie and went full like. Somehow that's meta. I don't know how that's meta, but somehow that's meta.
That's the only area of meta-ness that like Scream has yet to traverse. You know, is just to straight up make a Stab movie. And if all your leads are leaving, I don't know. Just make a Stab movie. Christopher Landon can do it.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at. We're gonna continue to watch.
Either way,
Scream
Marissa Barrera, Jenna Ortega,
out.
We salute you.
Yeah, we salute you.
And you know, to kind of put a cap on what I said earlier, if you guys are interested in how either one of us feels about a particular issue like that. Just ask, and I'll tell you. But like again, because we're an entity, I'm not gonna tell you how I feel about it on air. So up next in what's new, Alien news. I am so fucking excited about this.
Yes, we have been waiting for the Alien Romulus is the title. It's the Fede Alvarez Alien standalone feature that's been announced is coming out in 2024, and now we have some real information that's getting me real excited.
Turns out it's going to be in the original universe. It's going to take place between the first and second films. And Fede Alvarez has brought back almost the entire creative team from James Cameron's Aliens, which means fucking Tom Woodruff Jr., Alec Gillis.
Studio ADI in general. He didn't name drop them specifically, but he said...
They were the creative team.
He said he brought on the same people who built it, and those are the people who built it. So that's what I'm really excited about. I've said this numerous times on the show. I think... Their last work in the Alien universe, which was AVP, is probably the best the Xenomorphs have looked on camera.
Yeah.
So with all the technology advancements since then alone, I cannot wait to see what they do.
Well, I'm pretty pumped about Noah Hawley's
series
on Hulu as well.
Yeah, me too.
I think that's going to be much more long form. I mean, it's obviously going to be long form because it's a show. But I think that's going to be much more about the political machinations and how Weyland Yutani became Weyland Yutani. From everything I've read, yes, there's going to be a xenomorph in it, but like that's not going to be.
It's not going to be.
It's not
going to
revolve
focus.
Around the xenomorph.
Okay.
Which is kind of frustrating to me because like if you're going to call the series Alien, like it should revolve around the alien.
Better damn well be an alien.
Right. Like they could call it Weyland Yutani. And have.
Hey, you know, Prometheus kept me interested the whole time, and it was a barely xenomorph.
Yeah, but
focused.
They didn't call it Alien.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
That's like, true. Like,
and Alien Covenant had nothing but xenomorphs in it because totally. The word alien was in it. Just saying.
That's true. I do like it when people deliver on the goddamn premise.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, either way, I'm excited for new Alien stuff because I just love the franchise.
I mean,
and
same.
I'm just so happy to see that Fede is staying in the universe. And when they said standalone Alien, you know, it could be anything. But I'm so happy that he's sticking in the
Do we know who's scoring it? Because I
know
a guy.
I don't know.
I know a guy that scores things. I'm just saying.
That is what we have as far as what's new. Up next on our steaming pile of streaming picks, we have a very special Christopher Young edition of Streaming Picks. So these are all movies that Christopher Young has done the musical score for, and some of these he talks in detail about today, and you can go check out these movies and revisit them and reappreciate the music.
So up first on Hulu, The Empty Man. Now, I actually watched this last night, like I told you I would.
Cool. Nice.
I don't hate it.
The Empty Man is from director David Pryor.
Yeah.
This is a movie, I don't know why, this movie really grabbed me. And as Christopher Young would say, a connection was made. And yeah. I connected very deeply to this movie. And it was David Pryor also teamed up with Christopher Young again on his episode, The Autopsy of Cabinet of Curiosities, which is on Netflix. That's like a 1.5 extra streaming pick for you for that one. Up next, streaming pick on Amazon and Tubi, Hellraiser, one of his most iconic film scores, and just one of our favorite movies, period.
Yeah. Up next on Max, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Now, there are a lot of reasons to love this movie.
For sure.
I had no idea that Chris Young did the score on this.
Pretty amazing.
And he tells a pretty interesting story about how he got the job on this.
Yeah, and how they executed the music. So this is one I will personally want to revisit after talking to Chris. Because of that exact reason. So sure. I think that's a fun one. And up next on Netflix and Tubi, Drag Me to Hell.
Now, this is not one of your favorite.
It's not one of my favorite movies. Things. But I've always said that the music is the best part of Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
And I mean, I adore the music. And I actually listen to the music from Drag Me to Hell on my own. And no, it's not my favorite Sam Raimi movie for sure.
After watching it for the first time in a while recently, I think that it's a really good midway point for let me put it this way. When Charlie's old enough to start watching real horror, Drag Me to Hell is probably one of the first things I'm going to show her.
Oh, there you go.
Because it's not so hard that it's going to traumatize her, but it's still pretty fucking scary.
It's still scary. And again, Christopher Young goes hard on the music. The music amplifies this whole movie. Always worth a rewatch, even just to check out something like the music that maybe you hadn't focused on before. And up last, before we get Christopher into the room, our trailer of the week, a new movie that he is quite proud of, and he talks a little bit about this movie at the end of our interview, Piper, which is a film that's going to be an interpretation of the Pied Piper.
Kind of.
But it's going to involve Piper, and he's a coming for your kids.
Yeah.
And he plays a flute, and Christopher Young compose an entire flute concerto for this film.
Yeah. So yeah, check that out. It's going to be on the X-Files section under extras on our website.
So I guess we'll stop wasting time and talking about what Christopher talks about and just let Christopher talk about it. So let's welcome into the camp room Mr. Christopher Young.
Nice to meet you guys. How are you doing?
We are doing well. How are you doing? It's a pleasure to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you guys for letting me be a part of the gang.
Absolutely.
Oh, anytime. You can be part of the gang anytime you want. I love that jacket, too.
Yeah,
Graham,
that
by
is
the way.
Stellar.
It's pretty. I'm obsessed with I don't know what you call it, over-the-top jackets.
Sure. Oh, really? Do you have a collection of over-the-top jackets?
I'd hate to tell you how many I've got now. It's like an insane obsession. But I collect stuff as well, not just clothes or jackets. I used to do the Hawaiian shirts. I don't know why, but I get obsessed with these things. It gets stuck. Are you a collector?
I'm a collector. Yeah, definitely.
Okay,
oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? All of a sudden, you walk by something and you go, there's a flash and a connection is made. Where it comes from, I'm uncertain, but connections are made and then it becomes an obsession.
And, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've got, it's be one thing if I only collected one thing, but, you know, I'm always getting books, especially classic ghost stories. That's my favorite kind of fiction. I've got a massive collection of old ghost stories. I'm talking about authors that were writing in the 1800s, sometimes in the 1700s, and early editions of this stuff, early 1900s, this kind of stuff. I've been reading Algernon Blackwood recently again.
Hell yes.
And Oliver Onions. And there's so many. M.R. James. And it goes on and on and on.
What would you say is your top collectible item?
Well, you know, I've also got a massive collection of books on music and, of course, albums and CDs of all shapes and sizes, film music, and the 20th century classical stuff. I really do love all the craziness that was going on for a while when tonality went out the window.
Sure,
That crazy stuff that happened. I love that. But probably the distinctive collection that I've got that that is talked about a little bit amongst the horror aficionados is I have like a few hundred, I guess it's a few hundred, jack-o'-lantern masks, pumpkin.
I read that. I read that. That you're a jack-o'-lantern and autograph collector.
And which one?
And autograph collector as well, right?
Well, you know, not so big on the autographs. I mean, I was very much into the Universal, you know, character actors that did horror films of the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And I have most of their autographs framed with photographs of them.
That's super cool.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to beat that at that point, right? When you have that, what else is there?
And then film composers of yesteryear. You know, I've got the sheet music of the Tara theme from Gone with the Wind, and it's from Max Steiner, the composer, to David O. Selznick.
Wow.
And so that's kind of cool.
That's more than kind of cool. That's amazing.
Yeah. I have a Bernard Herrmann contract for a television show he did that's got his
wow.
Well, speaking of Bernard Herrmann, if I read correctly, that Bernard Herrmann is what sort of shifted you towards wanting to do movie stuff. Yeah?
That is absolutely correct. You are correct.
Excellent.
Truly. That's what's his name? Ed McMahon. You are correct.
Oh, which Herrmann score was it? Was it Psycho or was it something more?
But it was the album. It was the Herrmann album that was out in the 70s called The Fantasy Film World of Bernard Herrmann. It was on the Phase 4 label, and it had suites that he'd prepared for that recording from his fantasy films, including starting off on side one, Journey to the Center of the Earth. He had a suite from that. The second suite that was on side one was from The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. You flip the record over, there's a suite from The Day the Earth Stood Still, and it's followed by Fahrenheit 451. Four scores, four suites, two sides of a record. This is not the original recordings, this is re-recordings that he did, and they're just spectacular. The scores, of course, are spectacular, but the suites are kind of undernourished. He didn't feature that much of the score in these, but apparently maybe this is the way he wanted it, really, or because of the restrictions of the album side and the amount of minutes you could put on a side, it was decided we need to feature four scores. So you get roughly 14 minutes a score or something per side. But they work like gangbusters. The recordings are like, they've become standard kind of go-to recordings for how best to mic, winds and brass to get, so that you can really get a sense of the player being with you, but at the same time, not on a small room. It still has that room size.
Sure.
So, but at the same time, you can hear the clicking of fingers on the keys.
Yes. The texture of the instruments.
Wild. Yeah. On the woodwinds. And so it's just, I dropped the needle on that. There's so many places, we wish we could go back to, if we could move back in time, revisit things from the past, that would be one that would be kind of cool to go to. Would be not top of my list, but in the world of music, I would say it'd be probably the top, because I got that record I didn't know. I wasn't a film music fan. I hadn't even seen those movies. I liked the cover. I loved the stories because I was reading science fiction at the time. I was still drumming at the time and hadn't really gotten into writing. It was just, sort of discovering that. And I dropped the needle on that side one, the opening for the suite from Journey to the Center of the Earth. And it's like, what is, oh my God, it was like getting blasted in the face with a gust of wind, like indescribable. It instantly changed my perception of what music could be and who I was yet to become.
Dude, that's amazing.
That is an amazing
story.
I
love that.
And you say you brought up Bernard Herrmann Fantasy is the first thing you said. And it's funny because before we got on with you, he and I were discussing your style and stuff that we love about both like Hellraiser, Drag Me to Hell, or the other ones. And a fantasy element is something that I think is always present. Even when you're doing hard horror, you bring a fantastical element, I think, to the music.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, here's the thing is that maybe that's what it is. I've never heard anyone use that word. But, you know, I've always wanted or tried in the scores that I've written for these films to use the idea of music to enable the audience to step into the world of the picture in the way that they're not able to without it. It adds a dimension of depth so that the images take on a life that allows you to, as a viewer, feel like you're in that space in a much more immersive way. I can't quite describe it. But when I'm working on films, I'm always looking beyond the image. What is behind the image? What is this world that this director is trying to capture? If it's from a book, well, if he gives me permission to read the book, I will, and that will open up some, certainly open up doors that the film may not be. But as a general rule, you know, maybe I will not be guided by the director which yellow brick road to follow to get to the land of Oz in terms of finding that place where the music will really resonate. But that's what I'm trying to do. And then I'll shut up here. You know, it's been said that in the scores that I do, there's a human element to it. Well, you know, I've been lucky starting with really Hellraiser, where the films are actually what I would call classic horror films, in that, like any great horror story, there's tragedy in it. You know, it's like the person to whom the horror is being committed to or is involved in the horror that we're experiencing somehow is affected by it in the worst of ways. And they're innocent. You know, there's an innocence that's being taken away from them through the horrible experience they're having. And that's why Hellraiser worked, you know, I would say, you know, and that's why I think Clive was happy with it, because from his perspective, as I recall, the film was a very sick love story, bottom line, about a woman who was so, even though she was abused by a lover who happened to be her husband's brother, she was willing to do anything and everything for him, despite the fact that it was entirely painful for her, you know, at least the nature of the relationship was a disgusting connection, not a healthy one. So indeed, it's kind of a tragedy, you know, if you see it from her perspective. And that's the thing he desperately wanted the music to represent. I just finished doing Nightmare on Elm Street before that, part two. And he specifically said, I'm not looking for just scary music here, man. I just don't want impersonal screamer music. He says, if that's what you're going to give me, then I don't know how he phrased it. He wasn't like that, no. But he brought to my attention the fact that this was, the music had to take the picture, had to deal with the picture less as a horror film, more as a, you know, demented love story.
Now, how did you like coming on to Nightmare 2 as a sequel with, you know, certain musical themes already established?
Well, on Nightmare 2, you know, I was damn lucky to have gotten it because I think I was still at UCLA, or I just kind of, you know, I was just fresh out of there. I've done some Corman film and some new early New World films, low budget things. So this is a big deal, you know. Why did I get that movie? Charles Bernstein had done a score for the first one, which I think is the best. I've always said this. I've always said we should have all been asked to follow in his footsteps. He should have been asked to follow in his footsteps. When I came on board, it's not like I huffed and puffed and tried to push him to the side. I came on board because at that time, they were not happy with the score that he delivered. Why? Because not because I don't think they thought it was inappropriate. I just remember Bob Shea, who ran a New Line, said, I feel like I've been ripped off. They gave this money to this guy. I thought he was going to put it into hiring some instruments, you know. And it was it was one of the early days of home studio synth things. So Robert Shea just said, I can't stand the fight. As I recall, but this goes back so long ago, I may maybe mess this up, but I think he was displeased with the fact that all of the money ended up going into Charles's pot as opposed to spending money on an orchestra.
Sure.
So when I was brought on, it was with the understanding, you're going to give us a big orchestra. You're going to put every penny of this money into the ensemble, getting bunches of people into a room, because, you know, low budget horror films, it seemed like you bring an orchestra in and it enhances them. It makes the production quality of the film skyrocket.
Seems bigger. But it's interesting because The Nightmare on Elm Street 1 wasn't a big orchestra. That was a synth-driven score.
That's what I'm saying. But I don't know. Maybe he was surprised. Maybe he thought he was going to be getting an orchestra score.
Yeah, I'll bet he thought that with Part 2 coming out, there was probably more money available, and he probably thought, hey, if I'm throwing more money at this, I'm going to get a bigger sound out of it.
Charles was like, no, Part 2, that means I have two synthesizers now. That's it.
Right.
Just twice exactly. as many synths.
Well, you know, I don't think the money on Nightmare 2 was any great difference from Nightmare 1 when it came to the sure. music. You know, that, no, they were cheap. I mean, that's the way these companies, you know, they spend all the money in production. And so when it comes to post-production, the music's the last thing that gets put on. It's like, sorry. I remember that score being, I didn't make any money on that score. I sunk every penny of it into getting as many people as, like, I promised them I could get something like 35 people, you know,
wow,
into a room. And I remember renting out, it's now out of business. It was Chick Corea had a studio called Mad Hatter. It's closed now. But apparently I stuffed more people into that room than they had never had stuffed into it before or ever since. We had people nearly sitting on each other's shoulders for that recording session. It's a tiny
That's
room.
Wild.
And I crammed it with people. And I remember Bob Shea coming in, looking through the glass partition window between the console room and the recording space, and turning around. I watched him count. I saw him doing.
See, Bob doesn't care if they can actually play the instruments. He just needs there to be a lot of them.
Yes, that's
know?
Right. He didn't care. I need to make feel like this money is being spent.
Sure. He was like, can we get five more? Can we fit five more in there?
Can we get some animals in there?
Yeah, I was it. That's it. That's a low budget mentality. I get it. You know, what can we get for a dollar? You're telling me you can only get that for a dollar? Can't we get two of that for a dollar?
Right, exactly.
You know?
One thing you said earlier that really fascinated me is you're always looking for the meaning behind images, right? And you're so often doing music, but this is now you're here presenting your first book of photography. So now you're presenting the images.
Well, it's 25 books, right? Is that what I read?
There's going to be 25. I'm doing three. I mean, I started this a long time ago, and it's taken forever for it to get to the place. I wanted to have this full set of 25 books finished and signed off on before I even issued the first one. So it took forever. I wanted to be able to take all these thousands and thousands and thousands of black and white photographs that I have. Probably when I put those books together, I had probably 75,000 or 80,000 black and white photos. Now it's expanded to like 125,000. There's more. I mean, that's not, if I was a full-time photographer, that would be a whiff on an afternoon, I'm sure, for them. But, you know, for guys coming to this kind of late, I wanted to make sure that before I put these things out, which is a frightening thing, as you can imagine. I mean, here I'm a guy who's been writing scores for movies, who has this thing going on in his head where he believes that there's something going on here that he wants to share. That's all it is. I want to put them out there, and maybe someone will make a connection with one or a couple of them. And yet I'm terrified. I've been very lucky in that the responses I've gotten have been positive. Again, I think it's a lot of people who are fans of my film music and get me already. And, you know, it'd be one thing if I put out color pictures of kids playing, you know, running around in fields with balloons, right, popsicles.
Yes, but I think as fans of your scores, you know, you can't help but hear some of that music in the back of your head when you look at some of those black and white photographs and those moody images. So how did you go about trying to find the meaning in your own images when you were consolidating these thousands of images into 25 books?
Oh, how did I try to find some sort of connective theme?
Yeah. How did you find the cohesion there?
You know, it's funny. I guess it had been there with me all along, and it took, whatever, 50 years for the dam to finally break. And it broke by chance, as I think I mentioned in the liner notes. You know, I've never carried a camera around with me. I've worked in films, but I never really had... I was too obsessing with the music part, and I didn't go out and buy cameras. It wasn't until the cell phone became a way to, you could take pictures on a cell phone, you know, that everything changed for me. I didn't need to go buy something, never to hang around my neck. I didn't have to really know what I was doing. You know, I didn't have to go off and study photography. And it was just, I was down in the French Quarter in New Orleans, in that famous graveyard. I can't remember what the graveyard's called. But I was, you know, doing the touristy thing, getting into the vibe there. They don't allow you in the cemetery at nighttime, unfortunately. But that's the way it is with most cemeteries. The sun goes down, it's time to leave. But so it was daytime in the cemetery. And I was just taking pictures because I'm fascinated by cemeteries anyway. I was born right up the street, down the street from an old Quaker cemetery. So it was taking color pictures, and by accident, I pushed the black and white button and took this picture, you know, like close up of the gravestone. And all of a sudden I looked at it and went, oh, no. I don't know what it was. Maybe the same happened when
I felt it.
A connection was made. And I realized that in this world of black and white, which represented, by the way, all my favorite horror or scary films, I don't call them horror films, films in which there was an element of fear. My favorites have always been black and white. I've never really felt comfortable with scary films in color. Though there's some that I like, they never have done it quite for me as the black and white ones have. So there was always that element of, you know, when are we most frightened? We're most frightened as human beings when the sun goes down. Now, here in cities, we're protected by, you know, lights, street lights. It's never really completely dark if you live in a city. You live out in the country, sure, it gets completely dark. That's when things become alive. You know, for me, when I was a kid, I noticed that I had this attachment to the what my imagination would allow me to come up with about things that happen at night that you can't quite see. It's always just around the corner, you know, at the end of the street. You need to get to the end of the street because this really exciting thing is happening down there. Well, of course, you get to the end of the street and it's not there. And your imagination says, no, 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 no. it's actually on the other side of the lake where this is all happening. And you're always thinking about something that's out of reach. And the thing about nighttime is everything is out of reach, you know.
Well, I think that's something that a lot of horror fans can understand and share in, right? Because I feel like as fans of films with an element of fear in them, we see them when we're young and we feel that, like, that magic of that monster or that thing, that unimaginable thing. And we keep watching these movies as we get older and they don't really get scarier for us. But we keep watching them because we're chasing that dragon, right? That feeling.
What are some of your favorite films?
The original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Toby Hooper, 1974, one of my all-time favorite films.
Excellent.
The Shawshank Redemption. I always go back to that one, too. One of my favorite films. Frank Darabont.
Nice.
It's Thomas Newman. Great score on that one.
Oh, yeah. Tom. Fantastic, man.
Like you said, I'm really into some of the older Universal horror movies. In particular, actually, I just watched this one recently, and I think it's my favorite now, is Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, James Whale. Yeah.
It's just perfect. Like, so that good. Movie is perfect from front to back.
Oh, yeah.
We both agree on John Carpenter's The Thing.
John Carpenter's The Thing, I think, is another movie that is just so well done. It's such a beautiful homage to the 1953 version. And it's also Carpenter, like, forcing his way forward in the genre community and really mainstreaming a version of horror that really hadn't been done yet.
Totally.
But, I mean, score-wise, like, I'm a big fan of Howard Shore. Like, I had this discussion with somebody recently that was, like, singing the praises of John Williams, and for sure. The reason I like Howard Shore more is because while John Williams has a distinctive sound and you can hear John Williams score and know that it's him, everything that Howard Shore has ever scored is so unique unto itself and fits whatever movie it is that it's in. So, like, anything that he does, I can genuinely say I'm probably going to like that movie as much as I like that score.
I agree with you. All these composers are fantastic. All the films that you've mentioned are great. Again, the black and white world is still my favorite world. My favorite scary film, absolutely, positively, hands down, is the original black and white version of The Haunting.
Yep.
Yeah.
The Robert Wise.
Yep. That. I can't believe I didn't also say that, because that literally is my I love everything about that movie.
Yeah. I've been to that house. I've actually stayed.
What?
Stayed in one. Well, they only use the exteriors for the picture.
Sure.
There's only one interior is in the out in front of the lobby is when you walk in the big entrance. They shot some stuff in there, but all of the stuff within the house was done on a soundstage. But the exterior is still there just as it was.
Well, I think what makes that movie so brilliant at its core is that you never once see a ghost.
Exactly.
At all. You only see the effect of the ghost. And that is terrifying. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
Yep.
All, you know, great ghost stories. So much of the success of them relies on what the person who's experiencing is thinking, not necessarily what he's seeing, but what he's thinking about what he thinks he's seeing. You know?
Yeah. Right. It's more about feeling. It's more about, like, intuition. It's like, and once you always show it, it's hard to
mind.
Yeah.
Mind. Mm-hmm. It's the mind going, slipping away.
Yeah.
Top of my mind. I could give you a list of all these other black and white ones, but that's at the top of my list, I would say.
Hell yeah. That's a great movie to be at the top of a list.
Yeah.
To jump back to your photography a little bit, I was fascinated that you said that you became more interested in photography as things opened up to, like, cell phones and ease of use.
Yeah.
What's the general camera that you're shooting these photos on that are going to be get released in these books? Are these film photos? Are these digital?
Yeah, they're digital. Yeah.
Are we going to see some iPhone photos in these books?
Yes, you will be. It's interesting with the technology of all what I'm doing here. I'm pretty thinned out, not with it. That has been a blessing and a curse, because I feel extraordinarily guilty that I don't really know what I'm doing. I just see something, and usually at nighttime, and I go, oh, you know, and then I go, I know if I take it, you know, my cell phone a certain way and then modify the picture, because 90% of them are modified somehow. To the point where the origin of the source is so distorted, you don't even know what it was. I look at them and I go, I can't remember what I actually shot, that after manipulating it, it became this.
I don't think you need to feel guilty about that, though. Yeah, because, I mean, I think that's the point of, you know, the technology gets easier so that when you feel that spark of inspiration, you can just grab the damn thing and shoot a photograph.
Well, and I think that if what you see in your head is, and what you see in your heart is what you end up translating,
yeah,
then that's, you don't need to feel guilty about that. It doesn't matter what technology got you there.
I can sit down and have a conversation with Howard Shore or with any composer for that matter, about how I put things together musically. Put me down in a room with a photographer and he starts quizzing me on exactly what, you know, who are my favorites and where did I study and you know, technical issues and this and that. And I'm going to feel like, what am I doing in this room with this guy?
Sure.
And so that's kind of being underskilled with understanding the technology is only part of it. I you know, I've certainly have gone out and spent a lot of time purchasing or buying, you know, purchasing, going online, studying photographs by other well-known photographers, and these magazines that come out called Black and White. They show you what others are doing. But I must say that in kind of defense of what I'm doing, and I'm sure there's tons of others that are probably doing something just like this, but they're a little different than what I'm seeing for the most part in this black and white still photography world. Not quite the same. I'm not saying it's any better. I'm just saying, I don't see, and I'm wondering, and I kept on asking I had a professional photographer working as an assistant for me to get this to the finish line. And I kept quizzing him. I said, is this, are photographers going to laugh at me? Why don't they do things that are kind of weird like this and mess around? Is it because they've tried it, realized it's trash? You know, it's not worth the time of day. And he goes, no. I think these are special and they're not doing it because apparently they don't want to do it. Anyway.
Sure. Well, in a way, I wonder if you not knowing all the rules of photography, like, all right, let me put this in a musical analogy. Jimi Hendrix, mm-hmm. yeah. is someone that could never read music, did not take formal music lessons in any way, shape, or form. Whatever he knew about how to play the guitar, he taught himself in a way that there were no rules involved in, right? And look at
outside influences.
Right, and look at what he created as a result. So I am a pretty big advocate of artists of any medium coming into it sort of blind and maybe ignoring some of the rules, because I think that the rules are good, but they also kind of hamper creativity and they kind of hamper the possibilities for what you could do. So I wonder if that's kind of what happened with these photos, because I've looked through some of them on your website and they are brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant.
Oh, come on. That's sweet of you. I thought, that means the world to me. I can't tell you.
Well, it's true. I mean, what you say about them is true, though. Like, being a fan of your scores, I can see that in your photos as well. You can kind of, there's a very traceable line there. And
we've said on this show, one of the things that has drawn us to horror as a genre in general across the board is always atmosphere.
Yeah.
Tone, atmosphere is something that we treasure. And so I feel like you see that in the photos immediately. They create atmosphere from single images, which is not easy to do.
Yeah.
That means the absolute world to me.
Oh, well, good, man.
You know, I don't know if, you know, we're getting to know each other and I could see you, you know, hey, I will check out the pictures, but we really want to talk to you about is the scores. And I get it. Well, I'm okay. I mean, I talk about Hellraiser. I've talked about it,
sure,
like once a week all of my.
Well, yeah, but we also want to talk to you about what's important to you right now. And like, there's obviously a lot of you in these photos.
That's sweet.
You mentioned that you definitely spent time looking at like professional photographers' work. Who, if anybody, were some of your influences there?
Oh God. I would have to say David Lynch.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that because
I noticed. Someone said you should check out what David Lynch is doing outside of his films and his books, his photographs and other thing books. Said you should check that out because there's kind of a similarity. And I certainly have seen one or two of his movies and maybe they're influencing me. I wouldn't say in a direct manner, but there's a unity there, I guess. So,
well, talk about somebody who doesn't follow the rules. Like David Lynch doesn't even know that rules exist.
Well, and David Lynch is deep into, if you ever get a chance to take his like digital masterclass, it's all about harnessing creativity and being able, like, he doesn't get in deep into how he does it, but he does transcendental meditation in order to like come up with the ideas for his art, his photos, his stories. And he talks about how, you know, there's like the iceberg of consciousness and like the massive underneath of the subconscious where he draws all these influences. And I can see looking at your images and how you're like you said before, looking for meaning behind the images. You're always looking for like the hidden occult meaning behind what you're presented with. I just see like how David Lynch seems to be very similar in how he draws his influence.
Yeah.
There's a guy named Joel Peter Witkins, and there's a name that I can remember. There's so many who I should have written their names down who I've come across in my research and said, wow, this is really exciting. And unfortunately, they're not with me because as I'm getting older, my ability to remember names is not as great as it used to be. Composers' names, yeah, they still are there. but less so than the new names that I come across in the world of photography. But David Lynch, Joel Peter Witkins, again, I remember seeing his photographs for the first time, and like so many people, I'm not alone in that. What the hell? You know, this is spectacular. And there's my answer. You know, I wish I could.
Okay. I know, that's a great answer.
Well, then I get these black and white magazines. It's called Black and White. It's a magazine that comes out, I guess, monthly. There's so many in there whose names I can't remember, but are doing some really remarkable stuff.
Sure.
Though I don't know anything about them, really.
That almost makes it more beautiful in a way. Like, the anonymous artist is kind of a beautiful thing. It's beautiful when they get paid, too. but like, there's something really special about anonymous art in that way.
Tell me about that. Why do you say that?
So I'm a pretty big fan of like graffiti art and a pretty big fan of tagging. And I just think that there's something beautiful about seeing a piece of art, whether it's visual or musical or stop motion, whatever. And just knowing that it exists and not necessarily knowing who's responsible for it existing.
Like this, not being aware of the source.
Okay. There's something great. And with that, there's something great also about finding the source to this art that may have been anonymous.
The act of stumbling into something that you didn't seek out. And then once it's discovered, then there's this desire to find out more about this person. I just think that, you know, I see what you're saying. Discovering art and you're drawn to it not because of the name associations. So like, going to a movie because it stars George Clooney and I'm going to it because it stars George Clooney.
Yeah, and unfortunately that, you know, just happens a lot in art. Even in the horror world, that happens a lot.
I feel that the horror thing, I've got to tell you, it's a two-edged sword. I love it and I hate it. It's a blessing and it's a curse, at least in the world of film music.
Explain, how is that so?
If I was an author, like Stephen King, like Edgar Allan Poe, like, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, you write horror literature, And you can be considered a great, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, American author. People are willing to embrace horror literature in a way that they're not willing to embrace horror films nor anything else connected to them. Yes, there's a group of hardcore followers of horror films, but let's face it, they're in a minority. Most of your average Americans wouldn't touch a horror film with a 10-foot pole. Women I come across constantly who, when I mention what I do for a living, if they don't know me, I make sure I'm hesitant or very careful about mentioning the horror films I've worked on, because I know what the response is going to be if they're like your average American film goer. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying, you mention a horror film, like, oh, I'm sorry, I've never seen a horror film. I don't like going to horror films. Why would I want to be scared? So I'm sure I haven't hurt your knees. Michael?
So do you open with the shipping news?
Well, you know, I'll mention that, but they'll go, wait a second, that's a pretty old film. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's lots of other films that are not horror films. And listen, I'm not trying to sound like, you know, some old cantankerous fart who's upset that, you know, his career didn't turn out the way it should have been. But yeah, there's the element of the world at large not really loving horror music. You guys listen to it on its own.
Sure, but, absolutely.
You know, but how many people do you think actually listen to horror film music or picture?
You know, and I think if it was presented to people in a different way, I think they might surprise themselves. Because, for instance, at my undergraduate in college, George Crumb was our resident composer for a semester.
Oh, George Crumb, you were with UPenn?
We were at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Went to Muhlenberg?
I did.
Wait a second, my brother went to Muhlenberg.
Did he? Nobody goes to Muhlenberg, so that's amazing. Nobody's even heard of it. But we were lucky enough to have George Crumb there.
Oh, George Crumb.
And I got to see him conduct and play, and like it was... Like, you know, he was dipping the bells and making the sound effects, and he was doing essentially horror music on stage, but everybody was presented to it in the way that this is a classical composer. This is academic, you know?
Right.
And then all of a sudden the conversation was very different.
Oh, how right you are. If you took the same score, the same pieces that he wrote, and I love George Crumb's music, I truly do, and it's sad that he's faded. He's faded from the American consciousness. I saw him. He came into town once many, many years ago. And I said, George Crumb is coming to L.A.? Oh, shit. I got to go see this. And I went into a room, and there was maybe 15 people in the room. It was,
wow.
Oh, I felt so bad for him. You know, I spoke to him briefly. I was starstruck. You know, there's so many of his pieces that, when I started off, I was like ripping off, I would say, you know, like Echoes of Time and the River, his orchestral piece, his chamber pieces, his piano pieces, whose names of the, oh, you should check out if you haven't heard Black Angels. That was his.
Oh, yes.
Or Electric String Quartet.
Was that with Kronos Quartet that he did that?
No. No, Kronos Quartet has done a recording of it, but he wrote that thing in the 60s, or I think, or early 70s, and that was even before Kronos existed. It's been recorded by other string quartets as well, but the Kronos piece is fantastic. Yeah, recording.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I'm with you. So you went to school with George Crumb. You take that music and slap the title of a horror film.
Yeah,
do it, and you know, all of a sudden, he fall off the sheet of important American classical composers, and immediately thrown into you know, that horror stuff,
thrown down with the sodomites.
Well, let's talk for a second about your versatility as a composer. Like, that's kind of the thing about your career that, number one, surprised me and kind of tickled me. It's just the ridiculous spectrum that you've been on as far as films. Like, you've done obviously you've done a lot of, you've done Hellraiser, you've done The Dorm That Dripped Blood, you've done Copycat.
Sinister, I love that
Sinister.
One.
Sinister. But you've also done, like, The Shipping News and Bandits and Set It Off. Like, what?
Is there a type of story that attracts you, or is it, how do you choose your projects?
I choose, if they want me, I want them.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm not getting, the phone's not ringing off the hook anymore. And it never really was. There was a period when there was a great demand. But or a greater demand, but never so much that I was turning things down. I don't remember turning many things down. And of course, I like the idea of the diversity, because the fact of the matter is, I was lucky in that my head was able to function in a variety of languages. Maybe the languages are so varied that the person that's writing it kind of gets blurred, but nonetheless, I have liked being able to write in a variety of voices. They're all coming from me. Whether they all sound like they're coming from me, I wouldn't know. But big fan of tunes. I when I was a kid, I was listening to what was on the radio, and the Beatles and the Birds and the Beach Boys, or they were loaded with tunes and all that pop stuff and rock stuff. I loved the tunes that were written back then. And so my head was jam-packed with melody. And so, you know, in horror films, it's motives. It's not so much melody that horror films are known for. You know, you've got the motive for King Kong, you know, the three-note motive for King Kong.
Yeah. And there's the Godzilla as well. The ba bum bum ba.
Yeah, exactly. Jaws beat him. Yep. Just two notes, man. When he speeds them up, brilliant. You know, there's
Yep. Well, and I mean, going back to Bernard Herrmann, Psycho.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's like the most, yeah. And it's just two notes, and it's the most famous horror motif that I can think of.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just a gesture that's, you know, so equated itself with that movie. And it's just remarkable. You know, Harry Manfredini, my buddy Harry Manfredini. Mm,
man. Yeah.
I mean,
what would those movies be without his strings and that music that makes it?
By the 13th, we're talking, yeah, that, but. But more importantly, well, equally as importantly, it's the delay voices doing mine.
Oh, yeah. And again, because that's what horror is always about, the motivations and just reinforcing the subtext, the tone, the atmosphere, and the emotions of what's going on. I mean, and that you've just done that so brilliantly in so many films. When you start composing, where do you begin? Are you humming melodies to yourself? Are you sitting at a piano?
Yes. That's it. I see the film once after I get the gig. I probably have seen a work print of it before I get the gig, or maybe not. But I'll watch it once or twice, hopefully without the temp music, but probably not. And then I step away from the picture and I won't watch it for like, I don't know, 10 days, 12 days, depending on how much time I've got. I just let it seep into me, and then with the aid of, you know, the cell phone, I'll record anything that comes into my head into the voice memo app. And, you know, before that, it used to be the digital cassette machines and the regular old-fashioned cassette machines. And before that, reel-to-reel tape. But humming ideas into the voice memo, anything that comes into my head. Sounds, tunes, chords, whatever. And then after a period of time, then I go back, I sit down at the piano and listen to it and sift through it and decide, with the aid of some outside recommendations, meaning my assistant or the music editor, which of these ideas do we think have relevance to the movie? And then get their input. It's time to decide for what would these themes have relevance to, what character or or a situation or emotion, and then, you know, I then will lock them up, write these things out, lock them up, usually three ideas per major theme, and start inviting the director over to hear. Like, for instance, Drag Me to Hell or something like that. You know, I'll have Sam Raimi come over. I'll show him the main title. Usually it's the first thing I always show a director what I'm doing for the main title. I'll not show him just one. I'll show him two or three ideas, you know, maybe even more. I mean, see, is any one of them connected? And I try to make them sound as close to what they really will sound like with whomever is going to be performing this. And more often not, it's an orchestra, or used to be an orchestra.
So you're bringing in orchestras to do your rough ideas?
No, using samples. It's the synth mock-ups, but I usually include a live instrument. Like, I knew that Drag Me to Hell, the violin, again, the instrument of the devil, would be the perfect instrument to be featured. And so I got a real violinist to come in to play the theme. And actually, in the movie itself, that violin one you hear in the main title, that's from the demo. We kept that. The orchestra was recorded live. We got rid of the synths and put the live orchestra in, but kept the demo violin.
Well, so you mentioned earlier that when we're talking about scary movies and we're talking about genre films, it's all about the motif. It's all about the motive. What about when you score something like The Hurricane, which is amazing, by the way? Like, that's and The Rum Diary. How do you walk into scoring something like that as opposed to how you walk into scoring, something that's scarier? Because like you said, like, the scary movies are about the motif, they're about the motive. What is scoring The Rum Diary about? What is scoring The Hurricane about?
Well, before we close the door on the horror pictures, at the end of the day, horror films are not known for the themes that are written for them, the tunes, but rather the motives. Unfortunately, you know, my hang-up has been I like to write tunes, even for the horror movies. Now, it works if indeed you're trying to come up with something that's going to help us sympathize with that person or persons to whom the horror is being committed to, that we feel empathy for, or the monster itself, who is a freak because of something that happened to them that they didn't want to happen, like Frankenstein, like the Sandman from Spider-Man 3. He didn't want that to happen to him. It happened to him by accident. So it's a tragedy. So at those moments, tunes become a help. Too many of my horror films, I would say, were governed by my incessant need to kind of have a tune in them. The only one really where I said no tunes, time to come up with something that's motivic, that's kind of that becomes the sound of the movie was Sinister. And there's a little motive that appears in that a bit, and maybe that's it. I was trying to accomplish that, not do a long one, but a little motive thing.
Well, you did something right, because that movie was just voted the scariest film of all time.
Oh yeah, have you read that article?
I heard about that. Well, you know, I'm thrilled that it, you know, of course I'm thrilled, and that the music helped, great. But you know who else was a big tune writer in the horror world, you know, who liked to write tunes despite the fact that it was really all about, should have been all about motives, was Jerry. Jerry did his scary movies. There was usually a tune that held the whole thing together.
And you're talking Jerry Goldsmith.
A lot. And we talk about, Herman's psycho shriek, motivic gesture. Yes. But again, he did do, you know, if you listen to the main title Psycho, that's tuneful. It's a melody that you can own.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, exactly. You can hum this tune. It's not just a
who did Cape Fear?
Yeah, Cape Fear, of course. They're all that's motivic, but it's put together in a melodic way. Anyway, most of his stuff did have tunes as well. So much of his writing was about these two bar ideas that were kind of repeated and transposed or modified in minimal ways, but nonetheless, it all added up to something tuneful. Goldsmith was in the long line. So to get back to Hurricane and Rum Diary, definitely it's about coming up with the long song form bass tune. There's no time for, it's not the right movie for doing these little motivic things, rather to come up with tunes that hopefully are memorable. And on that one, I remember getting that job by getting on my hands and knees and begging.
You're talking about Norman Jewison?
Norman Jewison, yeah. I begged him to give me that job, and I said, I'm going to work on this like nobody else you've interviewed is going to work on this. I'm going to give it 120, 150, 220% of my energies and to make it the best ever score for this wonderful movie. And so I got the gig, and I remember the first go around or first couple go rounds, he was looking for that New Jersey sound because it's all about, Hurricane Carter. He was born in New Jersey, went to jail in New Jersey. And I'm from New Jersey. And so it was like, what does he mean by the Jersey jazz sound? I'm not exactly. I know Count Basie was Red Bank. But so it took a while to get the right attitude with the sound, with the music. But then once it was discovered, there is that little motive that starts the whole score off. So the whole thing is kicked off of that little line. And from there, it takes off. Half of the score, or a smaller portion of the score, is with the jazz band. The majority of it is with strings doing sort of Americana emotional, I don't know what you call them, like chorales. So it's all tunes. It's basically a tune-filled score. And I prepared a suite of that, which is going to get released sometime next year. It's like in three movements. And I've expanded that to add more trumpet solo, added some more voices, including a choir, and then a sextet of scatting voices. And so that's a jazz-based score. Fortunately, because I'm an ex-jazzer, I played drums. I get it. I listened to jazz when I was a kid. Swinging, I loved doing that. I did that when I was still behind the set.
Were you able to do any drumming on any of that stuff? Did you ever pick up the sticks again?
No.
I've never. Once I put the sticks away and put them in the closet, I've never, ever sat in front of a set again.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Because man. I knew I couldn't do it for fun. I was always working like a mother, trying to become the best drummer I could be. God gave it to me in my head. I can imagine myself doing all these wonderful things. I just forgot to give it to me in my wrists and my feet.
Sure.
So in many ways, it was a blessing that the film music, well, it was a blessing that I discovered film music. I had a rough time when I was at Berkeley studying jazz drumming with a very big, great jazz drummer who was on the faculty there. He didn't think I was as hot. I was that hot, and that broke my heart. But then I discovered show music, and it caused me to reinvent myself. So it all worked out really well. Now, Rum Diary, again, a jazz world. Jazz Latin world. And
yep, very much so. Very much so.
That's all tunes. Now, the thing that came out on the record you know, I but most of the records, most of the stuff that came out of the records, it's not so much the score as it is this multitude of tunes that I wrote wondering if these might be the right tune for the movie. It's like a textbook representation of this idea of me writing multiple melodies to try to hope that one of them will catch the director's attention, of which a few of them did, but most of them never made it out of the movie. And I thought that doing a CD of just these tunes would be much more exciting to listen to than a tune and then the underscore.
I actually have that soundtrack on vinyl.
Hey, that's nice.
Yeah, I'm a big Hunter Thompson fan, I think your score fits who Hunter was at that time in his life pretty well.
Oh,
like,
that's...
it's frenetic in its own way, but like you said, it's also cohesive. It's also got tunes in it. I love the way you use that word, by the way, because that's I've never heard that word used that way. This score is full of tunes.
And it's true, because I think about your music and your approach to horror, and as I called it fantastical earlier, and I think a lot of it, maybe it's just that it's very melody-driven most of the time, and a lot of the modern horror scores we hear are not melody-driven.
They're not melody-driven, and again, I'm old school. I cannot tell a lie. Like Howard Shore, we were raised in the aesthetic of those who were raised in the aesthetic of those who were raised in the aesthetic of those who founded film music in America, people like Max Steiner, Eric Wolfgang Korngold, Dmitri Tiomkin, Franz Waxman. These were all the composers who set the ball in motion and decided this is the way to score Hollywood movies.
Well, and you studied under David Raskin, right?
I did, David Raskin.
Who is pretty much the he's pretty much the grandfather of like modern or modern movie scores.
Did a few horror scores, but not many, you know.
No, he was he was insanely prolific.
And you have a lot of stuff still coming out. I've seen some stuff coming out about this Piper movie that you're working on.
That's right. I'm finalizing the CD for that. That's a really exciting picture. I'll tell you, I believe in every film I work on like there was no tomorrow. If I get accepted on a picture, man, I get so immersed in it and believe in it so entirely. The director, Ellinger, he decided like a lot of these gigs I'm getting now are from young directors who raised on the movies that I scored in the 80s and 90s. And so I'm thrilled that that like Bernard Herrmann, I'm not saying my music's like Bernard Herrmann, but, he had a coming back at the end there. I think everyone, he was living in London at the time, and everyone in Hollywood thought, well, he's dead, you know. No, he's not dead. He's around. So he gets hired by, again, the director that did Sisters and Obsession. What was he?
Not De Palma. Is it? No.
Brian De Palma.
Yeah, Brian De Palma.
De Palma said, gee, I'd love to have that guy who did Vertigo. Yeah, but he's dead. Dead. The picture editor apparently said, no, he's alive, actually. He lives in London. Really? Let's hire him. And of course, the score for Obsession, I think, is one of absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought that was a score that he wrote that maybe was thinking at the time, this is going to be the last one I'll ever write, because he was ill at the time and he did a couple more films and then passed. But I'm old school. And so up until the whole home synth thing started happening and the sound design ambient thing took over, every single film score was about the composer coming up with instantaneously memorable melodies, one or more, depending upon the needs of the picture. And then he took them through a series of variations over the course of the movie to align itself with the development of the characters and the story as they grew. And that got lost. That's gone for the most part, except in a handful of some of the fantasy films. Animated films do that, but in horror and suspense films, that's kind of gone.
I think we've lost a lot of what it is to have a thematic piece in a film and have something that goes through themes and that brings back.
Yeah, the ambient stuff. Listen, I use it. I'm all for it. It's like it's like a homegrown version of this earliest form of electronic, or one of the earliest forms of electronic music, called musique concrète.
Yes,
the French discovery by two guys named Pierre Henri and Pierre Schaeffer, and they, once the tape recorder was invented, was like, oh my god, we can record anything we want and then manipulate it in the studio. But what they came out with was this, you know, wonderful mishmash of sonic madness, and that has a place in horror films, so I'm all for it. I love that, and I think it works really well in the movies. But when you take it away from the movies, you put it on a CD, and since it's not, none of the music, or most of the music, isn't being shaped by the same principles that we grew accustomed to with film music, meaning theme and variation, we're kind of left with stuff that the average listener, it's like, I'm struggling trying to stay with this stuff.
Yeah, it's music that for many audiences requires the visuals for the context and otherwise doesn't grab, because it's not a tune. It's right, it's not, you can't hum it.
That's not good. I've always been a big fan and promoter of the best film scores are ones that do the job of the film, but at the same time can be removed from the picture and still hold our attention.
I completely agree. I think, and that's something that you've done time after time, and I think that's why we come back to some of the film scores so many times that you've done, and why young directors like David Pryor, I love your work with him as well, come to you for the modern films. So we're excited to see what you have coming up. I'm really excited to see and see The Piper and hear your work there.
Piper, I wrote a flute concerto for that. That's exciting.
That's excellent.
Because that's a story, that music is part of that narrative. Am I wrong?
Exactly. It's a retelling of the old Piper of Hamelin fable.
Oh, hell yes. Right on.
It's an evil piper who comes to take away the children again. But it concerns itself, it's said in contemporary times, about a cursed flute concerto that caused the death of a woman composer. And this flautist in this orchestra decides that she's going to try to complete the third movement for a performance that's going to be happening right around Halloween. And so it's her trying to come to terms with how to finish this concerto, written by this woman who was a friend of hers, actually her mentor. So there's a connection there, and all the tragic things that are happening to her because the evil piper is possessing her. So I had to write a concerto before they started shooting the picture, and that's very rarely done. And I'm extremely happy. It's a three movement concerto, 30 minutes. At the time I wrote it, they said they were going to need 19 minutes of it for the picture. I think there's only 9 minutes of it now, but I think it was not a waste of time by any stretch of the imagination.
And hell no, call up Waxworks Records. They'll put out that whole 30 minutes on vinyl. I guarantee it.
Yeah. Oh, it's coming out on CD. It's coming out,
I'm excited to hear that.
Trotter Records is putting out the CD of the score. I've got the three movements totaling the 30 minutes, and then I did a 20-minute continuous sweetified version of the score.
Ooh, so sweet. And do you have a plan for a physical release for your photo books?
Well, of course, I dream of that. I dream of doing a gallery showing of it. It's being suggested to me, and having my own music or something. Interesting, we never talked about that. But when I was working on these pictures, I was wondering what music of mine might work for these. And you're talking about, you hear them, you see the picture, they're all jive. I wouldn't know what music to put against these pictures. They're my own pictures. that would completely connect with what I'm trying to say with the visuals. But again, a gallery thing would be wonderful. Of course, if there's a gallery, there's going to have to be some music that's dark.
Sure.
But no, there's no hard copy book yet available. Nor is there one in the making. I'm going to wait and get through all of them and see what's the best thing to do here. Is the best thing to do to try to pick out the best of and put them into one book, or what do I do here? I don't know.
Well, and I want to make sure I get this right for our listeners as well. Your website is officialchristopheryoung.com.
That's right.
I highly encourage anybody that's listening to go look at the photos, to go check out Chris. Thank you so much for giving us your time tonight, man. That is that we I cannot tell you how much we appreciate it.
You know, I'm absolutely, entirely, thoroughly, 100% overwhelmed with ecstasy. I know it's kind of overwrought word, but you're the first people who've actually chased me down to talk about the movie, about the movies. Oh, there I go again. No, about the photos.
For sure. Well, we're fans, man. You know, and we appreciate art in any medium. So
we love just to talk about what makes people excited.
Yeah.
Whatever that may be.
All right, my friends. Great to meet you.
For sure.
Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it. There's Christopher Young, man. What a sweetheart.
Yeah.
What a good guy.
So much fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Passionate guy.
He's a very authentic dude.
Very authentic guy.
I really appreciate that.
Very authentic guy. This is what I love about him is, like, he has not lost the fire. He hasn't lost the passion. Like, hearing him talk about movies like Piper and the new stuff he's interested in and new stuff he's working on, and he's just as excited as any of these other classic films.
Yeah.
And when you hear him talk about it, you can tell. And that's just amazing to me. Like, the stuff he creates is magical.
Yeah.
And he really, truly, I believe, feels that magic.
Well, and one thing that I really appreciated about him that I was thinking about this morning as I was, like, going through my routine is he's really a bridge between old and new when it comes to Hollywood.
Yeah,
when it comes 100%. To scoring shit, right?
Definitely.
Like, he's really, he's, like, one of the last bastions of, like, old Hollywood scores, right? He studied under David Raskin, who was, like, the grandfather of Hollywood scores.
He says it himself. He's an old school guy.
Yeah.
He likes tunes, but he dives into the new school with movies like Sinister and tries to get just totally atonal. And, you know, it's all on the table for Christopher. And that's what I love. He's a guy who appreciates Thomas Newman and likes George Crumb. This is my kind of guy.
And Bernard Herrmann.
I think we were really lucky to get Christopher on the show. Go over to his website and check out some of these photos as well as his immense body of work.
His website, by the way, is officialchristopheryoung.com.
So go check that out. And after you get done on his website, hop over to our website at campnightmare.com. Check out the X-Files and all the other cool stuff on there. Especially, head over to the camp store and stock yourself up for the holidays. We got
kinds
of t-shirts and merit badge enamel pens and stickers and our Wake and Bake bundle with coffee mugs and grinders and rolling papers. And it's all at camp store, campnightmare.com. And if you just want more camp, head over to patreon.com/campnightmare. You can get exclusive secret monthly episodes, B-movie watch-alongs, discounted merch, and just more access to JB and myself. And who doesn't want that?
Who doesn't want more of us?
Yeah.
Yeah, and as always, guys, we would be remiss if we didn't tell you about our sponsor, Special Tees, special-tees.com, for all your printed merch needs. Trust me, they're the way to go. They're local to us, but they're international, man. They can ship to anywhere.
And they've printed almost everything in our camp store. So that's about it. Thanks for listening, everybody.
As always, I am JB.
And I'm Jordan.
Nothing, kids, is real.
And don't tell us what to do.
Thanks for listening to Camp Nightmare. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Slasher. And for full campfire tales, interviews, X-Files, and more, visit campnightmare.com.
And join our Patreon community of happy campers for monthly secret episodes, exclusive merch deals, B-movie watch-alongs, access to our Discord channel, and more. Visit patreon.com/campnightmare.